This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello, and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and those all over the world accessing the show on the internet. Our studio guests this week are Michael Doble and Brian Grist. Michael is chairman of the Thomas Chaston Society, and Malcolm Grease will be reading another of Chaston's great poems. But tonight, Michael is going to be taking on a completely different subject, the paranormal and the CIA. Brian Grist takes us back to the Beatles era and the impact the Beatles had on the music scene, and in particular the Soviet Union. Anthea Page reports on part two of Q Eco Village. Tony Gosling's feature is on Asbos. The Bristol Viva Palestina convoy is hours away from reaching Gaza after some delay en route. We're hoping to make a telephone link up with the driver, Sakir Yildirim, this evening. Our resident poet Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, has written a poem especially for Dialect Radio. Jeff Sparks is away from the studio this week, but he has sent the latest What's On guide, so we'll be able to give you that later on in the show. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Katie Austin.
And over now to our first studio guest, Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chaston Society. Good evening.
Good evening. Can I just say that there's no connection between the paranormal, per se, and Thomas Chatterton and the Thomas Chatterton Society?
Okay, well, that we know of.
That we know of. There may be, but that's not the purpose of our discussion.
Yeah, and the CIA, definitely, no.
We
can't accuse the
Thomas
CIA
Chatterton.
Of doing him in.
No, Thomas Chatterton apparently has no associations with the CIA, so I'm led to believe.
Right, so, I mean, the paranormal is quite a wide area, quite a wide subject. What exactly do we mean by the paranormal, and what has it got to do with the CIA?
Well, there are various different types of psychic phenomena or paranormal. I'll briefly explain the major ones as my understanding. There's telekinetics, which is the movement of an object without an ostensible physical force.
Mm-hmm.
Materialization, i.e. the materialization of a soul or a psychic form, commonly known as ghosts.
Yeah.
Ideoplasticity, which is ectoplasm, which typically comes from a psychic's mouth, strange substance. Mediumship or clairvoyance, which is the common one that most people know of, of when a clairvoyant speaks to a deceased person, a dead person, possibly using tarot cards or communicating directly.
Right.
Then there's telepathy, communication between minds without directly so doing. And more important for the CIA is remote viewing, where someone can inform someone of the location of a certain physical phenomenon, which is at distance from that person in time and space.
Right.
Particularly precognition, where it's done in the future. In other words, informing someone that in a remote location, something or another is going to happen in the future.
Yeah. So to put this in perspective, how did you first come across this subject and how the CIA got involved with this and sort of what struck it about you?
Well, it's a subject that I haven't looked at for a long time now. And it was something I did study for 10 or 15 years, but I stopped over 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was very interested in the subject because, well, it is a fascinating thing because it's unknown to most people. But I have had some personal experience of it. And the situation with the CIA is that it just came into my reading when I was studying examples of psychic phenomena.
Right.
And how the CIA got involved with it, so I'm led to believe, is that the Russians started using it in the late 60s. In the Cold War as a means of intelligence gathering, using people with psychic ability to inform them as to what the Americans were doing.
And did they claim to be successful in this?
Well, the only information I have relates to the CIA. I don't know how successful the KGB and the Russians were, but the CIA, they started a large program called the Stargate Project, which was conducted at the Stanford Research Institute in California, a $20 million project.
Okay.
And they met with varying results, but typically they could get at least a 15% accuracy on the clairvoyance predictions. Okay. But they used them primarily for remote viewing, i.e. letting them know where there were institutes, where they were researching into armaments and so on. But the second method they used them for was precognition, which is remote viewing both in space and in time. Right. So they predicted, for instance, when a new submarine was going to be launched or when a hostage was going to be released and things like that.
OK, so under whose presidential reign was this sort of project enacted? Who approved the budget?
It was in the 70s, you see. And so I think you're going to around President Carter or thereabouts. Okay. So I couldn't say whether or not President Carter himself approved the budget because, well, I'm not a psychic and I wasn't there. Presumably it was approved at a very senior level.
OK, right. I did read about Jimmy Carter. He also put forward $25 million for research into unidentified flying objects, which appeared to have been a bit of a bee he had in his bonnet for a while.
That's quite possible. I'm not aware of the details of that. But certainly he was involved in the Stargate programme.
OK, so how long did this project go on? Does it still continue?
Well, when the Cold War thawed, it was disbanded because it wasn't deemed necessary in 1995. The interesting thing is, though, with the 2001 event, the Twin Towers event, that caused an interest in this phenomenon again. And they started to look into starting another Stargate project to try to locate Osama bin Laden, so I'm led to believe. And they contacted the people who used to work for them before and asked them if they'd join the program again. Whether they have gone forward, I don't know. My own suspicions is they could quite well know where he is, but I believe they would prefer to know where he is and know that he's alive rather than to do anything else.
Right, okay. So what specific sort of case studies do you know about that the CIA got involved in?
Well, mostly, as I say, precognition, predicting where a new submarine was being launched, the release of hostages, I say, an attack on a US warship. They knew that a certain time in advance. One particular remote viewer, I correctly identified over the 20 years of the program, 150 targets.
But out of how many of this is what you wonder, isn't it?
There you are. I mean, in terms of quantifying it, as I say, the success rating was no more than about 15%.
Okay. But they evidently viewed things that continued for sort of maybe 20 years. They evidently considered it was good value for money, I suppose.
Absolutely. Apparently, it was only used as a last resort. When all the other forms of intelligence failed, they'd go to the Stargate people. So it must have been of some value, otherwise they wouldn't have spent so much money.
Right. Do you sort of give this a certain credibility because of any beliefs in the paranormal yourself, do you think?
Well, as I say, I've studied it personally, and I've attended many of the meetings held by the Psychic Society, and it is studied by very intelligent people, professors of neurophysics, professors of human psychology, people who understand the brain, etc. It's a very, very serious subject, but unfortunately it's been, I think, belittled considerably by modern television with these living TV, I think there are programmes about people going ghost busting and so on. It's a very, very serious subject because if there's any strength in it, which I believe there is from personal experience, and I might talk of that later, you're starting to look at the subject of the survival of consciousness after bodily death, the survival of personality after bodily death, and therefore you're into the realm of soul, a man's soul, the existence of God, and the destiny of man, and so on. It does lead into that. And when people say they've seen ghosts, they most probably have, and the question is, what is a ghost? Studies have been conducted where people have been weighed immediately after they've died. And this may seem strange, but apparently the human body loses instantly a very slight weight. And people have suggested that it may be the soul, if you like, being removed from the body. And there are many anecdotal stories of people who've come back from near-death and spoken of near-death experiences.
They did do a study recently where they tried putting a shelf above the beds of dying people in hospitals or people that they felt might be close to death, and they put numbers on cards on top of this shelf so that if you were sort of lying in bed in a state of being about to die, you look up, you wouldn't be able to see it. But if you were supposed to rise up above your bed and look down upon you, presumably, you should then be able to see what the numbers are. And the results, unfortunately, were that nobody did see the numbers. But Jonathan Caney, the astrologer, commented that seeing as dying was quite a stressful exercise, they may not necessarily be particularly interested in numbers, so that didn't really prove anything.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. I doubt if you're particularly interested in numbers when you're on the point of death. But contrary to that particular experiment, other experiments have substantiated this to a certain degree. If I can give a personal experience, my car was stolen And I spoke to a psychic I know, a very, very good one, and asked him about this occurrence. And he said, well, don't worry, I'm told that you will get your briefcase back, which has all these valuables of yours in it, and you will get the car back. Don't worry, everything's in hand, it will come back to you. And I said, well, thank you very much. And then nothing happened for 12 days. And so I said to him, well, nothing's happened. What's going to happen? It hasn't come back. And he said, well, hold on a minute, I'm getting some information now. And he told me this. The car is now stationary. It's been used for some time by the thieves, but it's stationary. It's in a high-rise, low-rise, mixed block of flats parked outside. Outside the flats is a system of railings, and the name of the block of flats begins with an H, and it's approximately 4 miles from where it was stolen. And I felt, as soon as I saw it, this is the block of flats. I then telephoned my psychic friend and said, because I wanted him to guide me to it. But unfortunately, he wasn't available. So I used my own psychic sense, if you like, and walked around the flats, feeling my way, and then went round a corner. There was my car. Now, the interesting thing about this is this can be ratified by the police, because I told the police about this chap. He's worked with the police on criminal investigations. He's told them where dead bodies are, etc. So I found the car, and that was it. And that, for me, was a proof, beyond all doubt, of course, in remote viewing. That's an example of remote viewing.
Well, that was fascinating, and thank you very much for coming in once again. And hopefully we'll be able to come in and sort of talk further or possibly on other fascinating subjects in the future.
Thank you very much. Love, love me do.
Okay, our next guest is Brian Grist. Good evening, Brian.
Yeah, hello.
We're going to have a discussion about the influence of popular music on culture, specifically the Beatles. Now, what is it that's taken your interest about the Beatles recently?
Recently? I've been interested in the Beatles since they started.
I was
a little kid, when it was quite obvious that something special was going on.
So I believe there have been quite a few articles recently that have discussed kind of the worth of the Beatles as cultural icons. So do you think that they're actually worth the hype, if you like? Did they always produce this great music, or are we looking back with severely rose-tinted specs?
One, yes, I think we are looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, but I'm not aware that there's much hype about them anymore. What there is beginning is a history of them, and that history is yet to be written definitively, and perhaps never will, because I think we're still beginning to learn about the impact that they made. The impact they made was historic and was colossal. I think people should be reminded of that more and more.
There have been several articles and radio programmes, actually, on
the
subject.
They haven't done them justice. Apart from one about Russia.
There was one saying that it did help young people nigh on the collapse of the Soviet Union to get this insight into Western culture, specifically its kind of freedom values. You know, this is the
correct
post kind of free love hippie generation, as it's been coined.
That wasn't what it started out as.
No, it wasn't how it started out as, but I suppose it's how it is seen. And certainly the more liberal values pervaded Soviet society, partly thanks to icons like the Beatles. So do you think it is relevant whether they were actually good music or not, if they were able to have that power?
They wouldn't have had that power if the music wasn't good. It's that simple. There was something exciting, young, vital, and completely new about the way that music was projected. And that has a lot to do with the recording technology of the time. And there's an artistry involved in that, which managed to project those ideas. And the phenomenal thing about the Russian connection here is it's only just becoming known because of the downfall of the Soviet Union and people being with more freedom to talk. And what people don't realise is that there was a bootleg industry started in the Soviet Union because they wanted to hear that thing. And the regime outlawed it. They said that you could not listen to this decadent Western musical values.
Well, that shows they must have realised the power it could have, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered.
No, but then came the trick, because the state took over the bootlegging industry. And the Beatles didn't get any royalties, of course. But the state actually started bootlegging the Beatles, which just shows the extent of the power that they had.
Well, this is the same principle. I mean, this is a very far-fetched leap, maybe, as Hitler and Wagner, for instance. I mean,
yes, that's very far-fetched.
He did use martial music to great advantage. He didn't write the music, but he used this to great advantage. So did the Soviet state tap in to the ability?
No, they tapped into the rubles. That's all they were interested in. They didn't want their own individuals going off bootlegging Beatles recordings and making money out of it.
It's purely a commercial move, then, not
totally
cultural.
Totally. In fact, if they had realised the impact of what they were dealing with, they probably wouldn't have done that.
What would they have done? Just left it alone?
Yes, that would have been better for them.
So, oh, perhaps they sensationalised it then?
Yes, they legitimised the bootlegging of Beatles records.
Okay. Well, perhaps are there two separate issues, you know, that perhaps we're going away severely from the Beatles' music itself here and much more into kind of the politics of culture.
You steered me that way.
Yeah, this is true. But I suppose the other question then is the Beatles themselves.
Yes.
You say they're not always good music. Why is that?
I think most of it is pretty good. There's something about the Beatles' music, and a close analysis of their first four albums holds the key to it. The Beatles made it at a time when they were almost four walking encyclopedias of popular music up until their time. They played records together, they experienced records together, they discovered music together. They were very, very close for many, many years. And they were, in their own words, in a bubble. And in that bubble, they developed this encyclopedic knowledge of the popular music of their time up until the moment that they went big. And you can analyse the work of any other popular musicians at the time, and you won't find that same depth and breadth. And it's all there on their first four albums, because they betray all their influences, they wear them all on their sleeve, and people like me and of my age, they open the door to an appreciation of so much more music than just theirs.
Did they do justice to their own knowledge in the music they produced commercially? Because George Harrison, for example, had a tremendous depth of knowledge there.
He did.
He made a lot of records with raga artists, that's Indian music in particular, and he had this fascination with Indian culture, which perhaps was unique amongst the Beatles. So do you think any of them were superior to the others, and did that come out in any particular songs?
Well, the old joke is that Ringo was the drummer.
Yes.
Full stop. You know, Paul McCartney, who, I must admit, an element of personal taste comes into this, and I've never been a particular fan of his stuff, but he was more interested in avant-garde music than any of the others. He did listen to John Cage, if that can be said to be listened to.
Who did the piece that was How Many Seconds of Silence?
Correct, yes.
How many, 64 Seconds of Silence or something?
Yeah.
In case you're not familiar with this, it's a fantastic piece. If you don't know the existence of this piece of music, it's where a man just opens the lid of the piano and there's silence
that's
for a certain
right.
length of time, and that's the music. So that's certainly very different from Ringo Starr's type of music.
Yeah, but not so different to what happens at the end of the Beatles' A Day in the Life, which does bear influences of modern contemporary classical composers in it. And that kind of range just was not available in popular music before.
So in a way then, when you're saying that the Beatles weren't always as good as we said, they did actually bring something that was very much invaluable to the culture of their day.
Yes, there's been nothing like them, and there probably will never be anything like that again.
But to be honest, nobody was really doubting that in the first place, were they? I think their success speaks for itself, but the fact
yes,
that you say that...
Yes, I mean, at the time, people did doubt it.
Really?
The first record, Love Me Do, was regarded as a novelty item, and they did look just peculiar and sounded peculiar. Have I got time to just say the big thing I wanted to say about this?
Yeah, of course.
on a cold, cold, snowy night here in Bristol, the Beatles didn't become popular until a thaw set in at the end of the big 1963 winter. This is also significant because they didn't make it in the United States until the United States finished the period of mourning of the assassination of President Kennedy. The Beatles erupted onto the world out of two traumas in two different nations. They also erupted onto the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc in much the same way in times of crisis. There's something in that, and we've still yet to understand and write that story.
Yeah. Well, they say some of the greatest artists aren't appreciated till they're dead. Perhaps that's the case of the Beatles, but I suppose the definition of what makes a truly great artist is something that we'll never quite know, will we?
No, we won't. But one thing you can be sure of, you can go anywhere in the world and people will recognise a Beatles tune.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much for that very interesting chat, Brian Griffiths.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And I'm sure if anyone meets you in the pub, you'd be happy to continue.
That's how this started.
Yes. So, thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Now it's over to the Eco Village in Kew for part two of Anthea Page's report.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting in the middle of the Eco Village in the sunshine, and it's lovely here. There's all boxes of vegetables growing, and I'm about to go into the community tent where the kitchen is. I'm standing in a large tent.
Yes.
I'm here with
Nick Ross.
Do you think more people could live like this?
Definitely, they could do, but do they want to? No, they're so used to living the lifestyle that they've got now, they don't want to exchange it. And although a lot of people come in and have a look around here and see what's going on, I still don't think they'll opt out, if you like.
So what happens if the goods, the supplies weren't there? What would people do?
Well, I think if you sort of wander around the world like you have done, you see how people survive on nothing. But you have to learn to make use of the resources that are available to you. Like these guys do, you know, they go round the back of restaurants, skips, find and salvage things. People round here bring an awful lot of stuff into the community.
So I think that you've hit the nail on the head then. This is a real community where people help each other.
It is, an ecological village.
And I think that's what we've lost.
You can live in a city like this and know no one. You can live in a small little village where there's 100 people and you still don't know your neighbours today. Where all these guys, you know each other. You can walk in off the street as a complete stranger. And to them, you're just one of them, you know. They won't stop and question your ethics, your religion or your principles. They'll just accept you as you are, which, unfortunately, most people don't today.
My name's Kaz.
And you're a musician?
That's right. I live just across the road from the Eco Village, and I spend quite a lot of time here trying to do some music and just giving general advice on living outdoors.
Have you lived outdoors, then?
Oh, for many, many years. For many years.
Yeah. Where was that, then?
All over Britain.
What sort of places?
Festival sites, gypsy sites, travellers sites. Yeah, they've kind of got a nice set up here and it's nice to be part of it.
So did you just come over for the social side then?
No, I come over to help a bit of democracy. I also come over to give advice on building toilets and living outside. And also, wherever you've got a community, there's always issues with recycling. And how to do this in the most efficient way. I am quite useful, really. Even though maybe in a wheelchair, I'd like to think I'm quite useful.
What do you think this eco-village, the impact will have on the community in general?
I think it'll have a fantastic impact on the local community insofar as people will get a different perspective on how you can live, how you can save energy, how you can use permaculture, how there's just a third way of doing things. I think that's a fantastic example to set in somewhat of this is a deprived area.
Do you think there's less depression in an eco-village because people work together?
Absolutely, without a shadow of doubt. I mean, just up the road on Green Dragon Lane, I live in a co-op, I'm quite blessed. But there's council accommodation that have tower blocks and they have no communication, they don't get to do things, they don't have gardens. So if they can come here, hopefully some of their needs are fulfilled, you know, and they get to speak to people and meet.
Not many people know how you grow vegetables. Yeah. It's quite easy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's extremely easy, you know, people just have to try. I think this has been lost and hopefully we can bring it back.
My name is Michael Anthony Vassell and my background stems from the old school electromechanical devices and then promoted into electronic devices. So I work with anything that's electronic, mainly computers, which I make and break and configure.
So what are you doing in the eco-village then?
Well, everybody needs some type of power, you know, whether for whatever appliances, whatever communication devices, and I'm working out a way to have been reusable, recyclable power from scraps, i.e. old broken electronic equipment that we can take apart and put back together to generate power.
Do you think there's too much emphasis on buying new stuff and not enough recycling?
It's like the old food mountain and butter mountain. Now we have been an electronic devices mountain. The lifespan of any new electronic device is 6 weeks. Then a new version comes out in the shop. So every 6 weeks, people are throwing away stuff. And that goes right across the board for all electric and electronic appliances. There is a major, major problem with that.
Do you think councils are to blame?
Before they used to take it away for free, now they're actually putting a price on the amount of stuff and the type of stuff that they take away from the households.
So what do they do with all the electronic stuff in the council?
It goes to the dump.
Yeah, but what do the councils do with that?
they send it, they don't do anything, they just send it to the dump to be crushed and then recycle the scrap metal, and obviously they get paid.
So why don't the councils recycle it before it gets scrapped?
They don't have the processes in place, the manpower or the technology.
So do you think that's an issue that needs to be addressed?
Oh yeah, very much so, because there's so many social housing establishments all over the country that everywhere you go at council estates there's fridges, washing machines, whatever. And because it's so easy now, rather than fix something, to just go and buy another new one, nobody bother fixes anything anymore. All the old tradesmen that used to do the call-outs, especially for the council, they don't exist anymore.
So what's the answer?
Sustainable living. I could say get rid of the council and put us in charge, but that's not going to happen, is it?
And that was the second part of the report from Q Eco Village by reporter Anthea Page.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Malcolm Greaves is going to read another of Thomas Chatterton's great poems.
An Excellent Ballad of Charity, attributed to Rowley by Thomas Chatterton. In Virune, the sweltry sun gan sheen, and hot upon the meas did cast his ray. The apple rodded from its paly green, and the mole pear did bend the leafy spray. The peed shillandry sung the livelong day. 'Twas now the pride, the manhood of the year, and eke the ground was dight in its most deft omer. The sun was gleaming in the mid of day, dead still the air, and eke the welkin blue. And from the sea, a wrist in drear array, a heap of cloudus, of sable sullen hue, the which full fast unto the woodland drew, hiltering a tennis, the sun's fetid face, and the black tempest swoln and gathered up apace. Beneath an holm, fast by a pathway side, which did unto St. Godwin's covent lead, a hapless pilgrim moaning did abide, poor in his view, ungentle of his weed, long abretful of the miseries of need. Where from the hailstone could the Almer fly? He had no housing there, ne any covent nigh. Look in his glommed face, his sprite to their scan, how woe begone, how withered, forworn, dead. Haste to thy church glebe house, a shrewed man. Haste to thy kist, thy only daughter bed. Kale, as the clay which will grey on thy head, is charity and love among the high elves. Knightis and barons live for pleasure and themselves. The gathered storm is ripe, the big drops fall, the forswat meadows smeathe and drench the rain. The coming ghastness do the cattle pall, and the full flocks are driving o'er the plain. Dashed from the clouds, the waters flot again. The welkin opes, the yellow levin flies, and the hot, fiery smothe in the wide lowings dies. List, now the thunder's rattling, climbing a sound, sheaves slowly on, and then embolen clangs, shakes the high spire, and loss, dispended, drowned, still on the gallard ear of terror hangs. The winds are up, the lofty elmen swangs, Again the levin and the thunder pours, and the full clouds are brassed at tennis in stonen showers. Spurring his palfrey o'er the watery plain, the abbot of St. Godwin's convent came. His chaponette was drented with the rain, and his panked girdle met with mickle shame. The Yanewood told his bead-roll at the same. The storm increasing, and he drew aside with the mizzed alm his craver nearer to the home to bide. His cope was all of Lincoln cloth so fine, with a gold button fastened near his chin. His outre mate was edged with golden twine, and his shoon peak a lover's might have been. Full well it shone, he thought, and cost no sin. The trammels of the palfrey pleased his sight, for the horse millionaire his head with roses dight. An almus, sir priest, the dropping pilgrim said. Oh, let me wait within your covent door till the sun sheeneth high above our head and the loud tempest of the air is o'er. Helpless and old I am, alas, and poor. No house, ne friend, ne money in my pouch. All yet I call my own is this, my silver crouch. Varlet, replied the abbot, cease your din. This is no season almas and prayers to give. My porter never lets a fater in. None touch my ring who not in honour live. And now the sun with the black cloud as did strive, and sheeting on the ground his glary ray. The abbot spurred his steed, and eftsoons rode away. Once more the sky was black, the thunder rolled. Fast, reigning o'er the plain, a priest was seen. Ne dightiful proud, ne buttoned up in gold, his cope and jape were grey and eke were clean. A limitor he was, of order seen, and from the pathway side then turned he, where the poor Alma lay beneath the holman tree. An almus, sir priest, the dropping pilgrim said. For sweet Saint Mary and your order sake. The limitor then loosened his pouch thread, and did thereout a groat of silver take. The Mr. Pilgrim did for Hallin shake. Here, take this silver, it may ease thy care. We are God's stewards all, net of our own we bear. But ah, unhaly pilgrim, learn of me. Scathe any, give a rent roll to their lord. Here, take my semicope. Thou art bare, I see. 'Tis thine. The saints will give me my reward. He left the pilgrim, and his way aboard. Virgin, an holy saint who sit in glory, or give the mighty will, or give the good man power.
Thank you to Malcolm, and if you would like to find out more about the life and work of Thomas Chatterton, you can log on to the Thomas Chatterton Society website. Just stick the Thomas Chatterton Society into Google, and that will bring it up. Membership is only £5 a year.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It In a report delayed from 2 weeks ago, we'll be hearing why human rights lawyers across the country are condemning control orders and ASBOs as an affront to justice. Human rights lawyers around the country have been pointing out that those who are issued with control orders and ASBOs are not getting a fair deal in the justice system. In criminal cases, the burden of proof is weighted in favour of the defendant, but in civil law, it's what is known as the balance of probabilities. ASBOs and control orders are a mixture of both, with criminal sanctions but only a very loose burden of proof, as in civil law. Lawyers and judges don't like them, as Michael McColgan from Howells Solicitors in Sheffield explained recently. He, like many lawyers, see these new measures as far too easy for the police to obtain, and there is also the small matter of special advocates.
Special advocates were brought in allegedly to right the wrong done for people, because they said some of this information is so sensitive that we'll have to divide the court hearing into the open sessions and the closed sessions. The open sessions are the most general ones, where they say simply things like, you're a threat to national security, your being here is not conducive to the public good, so forth and so on. The secret sessions are supposedly where they get down to the nitty-gritty. Unfortunately, fortunately for the government, the defendant is not allowed to be there. His lawyer is not allowed to be there, but the special advocate can be there. And the special advocate can go into those closed sessions and he can look at that closed evidence and he can make submissions. He can even submit that it should be disclosed to the defendant. I don't know of any case where that's ever happened, but he can submit that. But the important thing is that special advocate, who's the one who sees the evidence, the real basis on which this man is detained, is not allowed to talk to the defendant or his lawyers about what he's seen. So there he is in this parallel universe in the closed sessions, arguing the toss about evidence which he's privy to, which the court is privy to, but not that. Not the defendant or his lawyer. So in other words, they remain in complete ignorance. He may be the most able of special advocates, and there have been some very able special advocates, Nicholas Blake, Ian MacDonald and so forth, is well known in Manchester because he's got Garden Court Chambers in Manchester and also Garden Court in London. Many of them have resigned because they've said, we are in a procedure, we're giving credence and credibility to a procedure which is in fact deeply flawed and deeply unjust. And a large, large number of special advocates, incidentally the government says it doesn't know how many special advocates it has appointed. Can you believe that? This is a government which is mad on statistics, mad on drawing up tables. We cannot tell you how many special advocates we've appointed. And certainly they're not going to tell you how many special advocates have resigned. The other thing is, you have a right to confront your own accuser. This is a fundamental thing. Let them stand in front of me and say what they say so that I can answer them back. I can cross-examine them. How can you cross-examine somebody when you don't know what they're saying? And you've got to remember, the important thing to remember about the proceedings of the Special Immigration Appeal Commission, is that the whole thing is based not on a reasoned case with evidence of the kind that you'll get in a criminal trial. If I'm accused of murder, there will be witnesses there saying, I saw X hit Y with a sledgehammer 15 times over the head. I saw Y aiding and abetting him with throwing the body into the canal. And I saw Z burning all the clothes so that there wouldn't be any identification evidence afterwards. Yeah, that's all hard evidence. Nothing of the kind here, because what we're fighting against is not evidence of the kind that could be brought to court, but reasonable suspicion of the Home Secretary. And where does that reasonable suspicion come from? It comes from MI5, it might come from SIS in Pakistan, it might come from the security forces in Algeria, and to a large extent it comes from France. Now, I did, as a lawyer, I did a report on the application of anti-terrorist legislation in France 10 years ago. My conclusions still hold then, that in fact a lot of people are convicted of terrorist offences in France and then their presence in Britain is endangered on the basis that he knew him, who was the mother of X, who was the cousin of Y, who was a distant relative of somebody else, who worked for so-and-so, who had some vague connection with either the FIS or the GIA in Algeria. So in other words, it's not what you did, but who you knew, and it's guilt by association. Information, I am convinced, has come from France, and I know this in a couple of cases for certain, indicating this man, although he wasn't convicted, he's a dangerous man, and we weren't simply able to nail him. This is where the British... So it's reasonable suspicion. So you're not fighting against hard evidence, even in the limited confines of the Special Immigration Appeal Commission. You're fighting against these nebulous concepts of suspicion, inklings, hypotheses, and the rest of it. That is what makes it doubly unjust. And then that, of course, covers the right to counsel. So in other words, that is something which is peculiar to the Special Immigration Appeals Commission. But what I want to suggest is that, in fact, that is spreading like a contagion through the whole criminal justice system. And I want to jump from those kind of immigration cases to ASBOs. Yeah? ASBOs are supposed to clean the streets of people who indulge in behaviour likely to cause alarm, harassment or distress. Mainly young kids from 10 upwards. The age of criminal liability in England is lower than anywhere else in Europe, incidentally. In Belgium, you can't be tried in a criminal court under the age of 18. But in Britain, of course, we know that everybody is liable for their own actions from the age of 10 upwards. So ASBOs encompass a whole stratum of young people. ASBOs are originally sought in civil proceedings. Now, the difference between criminal and civil proceedings is this, that in criminal proceedings, the standard of proof is supposed to be beyond a reasonable doubt. That is interpreted by the judges as members of the jury. If you convict this person, it is because you are sure. Yeah? Now, I think that, in fact, is watering down the concept beyond all reasonable doubt. But anyway, it's sure. The standard in civil cases is on the balance of probabilities. So, in other words, when assessing or if somebody's behaviour is ASBO-worthy, it's just on the balance of probabilities. Now, also in these ASBO proceedings, the court can take hearsay evidence. What we get, and I've done several of these, is a policeman will come in and the prosecutor will sort of say, well, what's your evidence? He will say, blah, 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 blah. And then a lady further down the road, I don't want to give the number because she's afraid to come to court and she's afraid of recriminations. She says that these boys have been banging on her window, smashing her garden gate, doing this, that and the other, letting a firework in her kitchen, so forth and so on. Right. Then they read a statement from somebody, unidentified, anonymous, and the judges, to a man and a woman, are allowing this hearsay evidence in. Hearsay, it's double hearsay, it's third hand, it's fourth hand, or whatever. Now, that 20 years ago would have been unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable. But it's a bit like the right of silence. You remember the right of silence when the Conservative government made its first move to outlaw that? Douglas Hurd, Home Secretary at the time, said, this is only going to apply in terrorist cases. Yeah? What's the position now? The right of silence is effectively abolished in ordinary burglary shoplifting cases. Because there's a Section 34 of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act where the judge can tell the jury, if he said nothing in the police station and now says something in court, you can draw adverse inferences from it. Yeah? So in other words, the right of silence, it started off as an exceptional measure, the abolition of it, and it's now become the norm. And what I'm afraid of is that this secret evidence of which SEAC is the embodiment is filtering through into all kinds of other organisations.
Thank you to Michael McColgan from Sheffield Solicitors Howells. He was speaking at the National Union of Journalists Ethics Council Fringe meeting on terrorism in Southport last month.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now for our telephone link-up with the Bristol Viva Palestina convoy. The people on the convoy are having a bit of an interesting time, so we've contacted Ed Hill. He's based in Bristol, and what he does is keeps in contact with everybody who's on the convoy. So we're going to go over to him now and find out what's been happening.
Hello.
Oh, hi there. First of all, can I say thanks very much for the regular and
continued coverage that your radio station is giving to the convoy. It's really good, and what we really value about community radio.
Okay, well, you're very welcome. How are you linked in with the convoy?
I send out the press releases here in Bristol. I'm generally doing the media work at what we call base camp back here in Bristol, while the convoy has been going across Europe, down through the Middle East, and getting close but not quite there to Gaza. So I can give you a quick rundown if you want.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant, because the last time we managed to get in contact was about 2 or 3 weeks ago before Christmas, and we'd succeeded in driving across Turkey, and we're heading south.
Here, who's driving the marvellous 44-ton truck.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the Gert Biggun, broad Bristolian, of course.
Yeah.
It's got the Banksy-style murals, the scenery of Bristol on one side and Wallace and Gromit on the other. So we're very proud. And every time there's a press TV news coverage of the convoy, we're all there spotting our big truck.
Oh, brilliant.
Or any of the other vehicles or the 9 Solidarity visitors who are travelling with it as well.
Okay, right.
Your question is, have they got to Gaza?
Indeed.
Almost. All right. They were welcomed through the Middle East, Turkey, Syria and Jordan, and we're talking crowds by the sides of the road, people waving flags, people crying, people extending enormous amounts of hospitality. They've had a tremendous welcome, and it just shows how important these convoys are.
Mm.
Their route was to follow, in fact, the route that Shakir drove in his ambulance last winter, which was to go down to almost the bottom of Jordan, port of Aqaba. And there's a short ferry ride just across the Straits of Aqaba, and they would then arrive at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula and then into Egypt. But at that point, Egypt decided that it was going to be difficult and denied them entry. And Bristol people are a foisty lot. Some went on the hunger strike, some marched up the nearest mountain with a giant banner, other people marched along the beach as there's a shared border with Israel, and I understand they got shot at or something. So it got pretty hairy there, even in Jordan, but they had to turn around, drive 400 miles back up to Syria. Turkey has paid for a ship, a ferry, to take all the vehicles down the Mediterranean coast to then arrive on the Mediterranean coast of Egypt at the port of Al Arish. A few other hairy moments. Israel decided to feel a bit difficult about its coastal waters there, and the ferry was actually shadowed by 2 Israeli warboats, warships or something. Anyway, the vehicles got to Al Arish. The people were having to be ferried by plane. Small airport at Al Arish, small plane, had to do 4 journeys. Bit of a technical breakdown. The first group arrived a day ago, were held at the airport. They were then being messed around by the Egyptians on visas and such like. Bit of a protest at the airport. Today, the other 3/4 of the group then arrived by plane. They are now reunited with their vehicles. Egypt again was throwing every spanner into the works it could, extortionate port fees, saying some of the people couldn't come in, all got very complicated, lots of protesting. I've been getting reports this evening. The people and the vehicles are together.
Mm-hmm.
They're locked in a compound and are not allowed to leave. They describe huge numbers of riot police outside and even a water cannon to keep them in that compound. What we can guess is that Egypt is keeping them there until the middle of the night or tomorrow morning. They will then allow them to go to the Rafah crossing, which is fairly close. It's like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom when the great stone doorway is closing. It's the same situation with the Rafah crossing. Egypt so generously opened the crossing on Sunday and is going to close it again tomorrow evening. So the clock is ticking that they can even get in, deliver their aid, and then get out before that crossing is closed. I mean, we're non-political. We're just sending humanitarian aid to people who need it.
Mm.
But you can see how the politics of this situation is biting the convoy at every turn.
Yeah, there's an incredible amount of politics involved on something that's getting very little media coverage. Do you feel disappointed by that?
Very little media coverage, other than a few exceptions, including yourselves. Yes, it's an international crime, in my opinion. Not only that Gaza is under siege from Israel, but without Egypt's compliance, you know, that siege couldn't be complete. Gaza's been under siege for more than 3 years, and the essentials of life, many other things, even since the ghastly attacks last winter, are not being allowed in. By the way, Egypt is being paid by America enormously for what it's doing, and receiving special technical equipment, sensors to go along the border, special drilling equipment to break through into the tunnels, which are mostly used to take in food and other life essentials. Terrorist tunnels is just the label the media puts on it. Flooding those tunnels with seawater. And the latest thing is America sent special pile driving equipment to send steel plates 25 metres down into the ground to cut off those tunnels. It's called the Iron Wall or the Underground Wall. That's the extreme extent that Egypt is going to complete the siege of Gaza. So it's a crime.
I was going to ask, what does Egypt have in its favour to create such an incredible amount of difficult problems for them?
A lot of aid from America. I mean, if you list all the countries in the world that get American foreign aid, Israel is number one. Yeah. Not exactly destitute, is it?
No.
And I understand Egypt comes very close next on the list.
Right, okay.
I understand that America pays the entire security bill for Egypt, and it is a very repressive regime.
London.
Its own people, as well as anybody trying to send aid to Gaza. Yep, the world is a bad place run by bad people. That's why we, the ordinary people, what you're doing, media stuff, what we're doing to try and send humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza who need it. Somehow the ordinary people have to do what the government wants to get in the way of.
And finally, if Egypt do refuse to allow them to return, what are they going to do? They're going to be stuck with their vehicles?
I mean, at the moment, our bets are on the fact that they'll allow them to scurry in and out very quickly with just 24 hours. That's what's happened before.
Right.
That the convoys go in with just 24 hours to deliver stuff and then come out again, just to narrow things down as much as possible. It's a tragedy. I mean, our people have been travelling since the beginning of December to get there and just to have such a short length of time.
Right.
But you can bet they're going to have an extra message. When
and everyone is generally well?
So far, so good. You know, a few little tummy bugs and scrapes along the way, but everyone is alive.
Okay, and where can we follow them on the web, their journey and the progress?
We have our own website for the Bristol stuff. It's actually a membership site, so it's a Ning type social networking website. http://bglink,
yep.
Which is short for Bristol Gaza Link,
mm-hmm.
bglink.ning.com. Sign up and become a member there, and
okay.
You'll be good company, because the purpose of this social networking site is to create links with Gaza, and we have a lot of members over there, including the mayor of Gaza.
Oh, brilliant.
As regards to the convoy itself,
mm-hmm.
If people Google Reading PSE,
yep.
PSE is short for Palestine Solidarity Campaign,
yes.
They'll find an amazing website which really is doing all the logging of the progress on behalf of Viva Palestina. I think their people haven't been able to keep up with it. There's somebody working very hard in Reading.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to us, Ed Hill, and we will, of course, follow their progress and speak next week.
You're doing as well. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much to Ed Hill, and we'll keep up with what's going on next week. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and resident poet on Dialect Radio, is here to read you his latest poem. Hello.
Hello, Sean. Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. What did you do for
right.
New Year's Eve?
I was required to first foot.
What's that?
Well, I was at the party of this friend who's from the north.
Yeah.
And in the north, they still, I think, have this tradition of having a... Well, preferably a tall, dark-haired male will be the first to cross the threshold after midnight.
Oh, what, going out of the house?
So you must go out of the house.
Oh, and then go back in.
And have a lump of coal, a pinch of salt, and a few coins.
Okay.
To present to your host.
And they do what with these eccentric selection of verses?
The particular combination of odds and ends,
yes.
Varies with geographical, you know.
Okay, oh, well, that's very inspiring. It's excellent. Well, on to your poem, which yeah. I believe you've written especially for us.
I have indeed, yes. This is, it's about the New Year and the end of a decade.
Okay.
So could appropriately called dates. Yeah. A change of date feeds rumination, regrets, remembrances, and things that trigger off the calibration of what the shifting date may bring. In the temples of the ruined nation, the choirs sing out familiar songs. They drag out for the celebration to help us feel that we belong. The calendric notches aggregation carves the score into our heads, while conscious of the shifting station, the living count the passing dead. The decade smells of degradation as decadence drifts out of style, while the rising tide of consternation besieges those still in denial. Dates always bring their expectation where hope and helplessness collide. They arrive without an invitation. The future has nowhere to hide.
And may that bring much rumination as to what's going to happen in the next decade. I'm sure it will be very interesting. Hopefully Dalek will still be here in 10 years' time and we can have a big discussion about it all and have you back.
Thank you.
Jeff Sparks is away, unfortunately, but he's sent in this week's What's On in Bristol guide, so I will now read it out for you and announce the song of the week. Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dalek Radio. Starting with Thursday the 14th of January, and Rita Lynch will be performing with support from Ella and the Goatmen at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Also on 14th of January, City of Fire, which features Burton Seabell and Byron Stroud of Fear Factory, will be performing with support from Illuminatus at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm again and tickets are £10 in advance. Moving on to Friday the 15th of January, Twisted will be performing with support at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £4 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Marillion. This is from the album Fugazi, which was released in 1984 and is the track titled Punch and Judy. That was Marillion with Punch and Judy from the album Fugazi, or should that be Fugazi, I don't know. For more information on them, you can check out www.marillion.com, that's M-A-R-I-L-L-I-O-N, in Marillion. Into Saturday the 16th of January, Atomic Rays will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and entry is £5 on the door. Also on the 16th of January, the Red Hot Trio will be performing at the Rolleston, which is at 73 Commercial Road in Swindon. Doors open at 8:30pm and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday the 19th of January, Seragon will be performing with Terraform in The Absence of Light, Between the Embers, Traitorborn, Centuria, Hope of the Hatred, Hated, and also The Hollow at The Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 4pm. And tickets are £5 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
And that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Today's studio guests were Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, Brian Grist and Malcolm Grieve, who read the Chatterton poem earlier on.
features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and thank you very much to Johnny Royden and the Man With No Name for their engineering faculties. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, read us one of his very own compositions, and may he return in future weeks. Jess Sparks, in fact, didn't bring you the very latest What's On because he couldn't be with us, but Case Jotton read it in her excellent voice, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, and from Katie Austin also. Until next week, take care. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectsradio.co.uk.